I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Ahead this evening, preservationists broaden their effort to save part of a Revolutionary War battlefield in New Jersey. First, we're some 6 weeks out from Tax Day, and Philadelphia is spending around $1 million on a campaign to get more low-income residents to sign up for the Earned Income Tax Credit. WHYY's Katie Culinary reports the credit is considered one of the country's most effective anti-poverty programs.
Maybe you've noticed the posters on the subway with the mom, dad, and two cute kids. Or maybe you've heard the ads on Pandora.
Hey, Philadelphians, you may be eligible for a federal Earned Income Tax Credit refund up to $6,000.
They're part of the city's push to get more residents to sign up for the credit, which is different from a deduction. The EITC is designed to give low-income workers back more from the IRS than they paid in income taxes. So a family of five earning less than $54,000 a year could get more than $6,000 back. Elizabeth Kneebone with the Brookings Institution says the EITC helps lift millions of Americans out of poverty every year.
Because it's a refundable credit, meaning that workers can receive whatever's left over after offsetting tax liability in their refund, that extra income helps boost families above the poverty line.
And because it only goes to working people, it's one policy both Republicans and Democrats like. In Philadelphia, about 200,000 residents are eligible for the EITC, but last year, 20% of them didn't apply. City Revenue Commissioner Frank Breslin says those people left a combined $100 million on the table.
The numbers kind of just jumped out at us, and we thought this is something that we should really engage in.
Breslin says the city convened focus groups to find out why so many people weren't applying for the EITC. A lot of people had never heard of it or couldn't afford good tax preparation services. People like Rosalind Sanders from Southwest Philadelphia.
I thought it was just for certain people, like if they had children. That's what I figured it was for. Yeah. I never thought we were eligible for it.
Last year, Sanders and her husband got their taxes prepared for free by a local community organization and found out they did qualify for the EITC. 1 week later, Sanders says they got a check in the mail for more than $3,000.
I felt so good. I came back and brought these guys pizza. I did, just the whole staff, because I really appreciate what they had done.
In addition to four boxes of pizza, Sanders says she used the money to pay her car loan and other bills that were a little behind. This year, two nonprofits are being paid to provide free tax preparation services in locations across Philadelphia, the suburbs, and South Jersey. Michelle Arthur runs one of the free tax sites in North Philly. She says so far, the campaign seems to be bringing in more people who are eager to find out if they qualify for the EITC. But Arthur has noticed that while families with children are getting thousands of dollars back, people without kids are only getting a few hundred dollars at most.
We shouldn't be penalized for being single. You know, it's our choice if we don't have children or if we don't get married. You know, our bills don't change. We still pay the same mortgages. We still pay the same car notes. And it's just not fair.
Change could be on the horizon. Both President Obama and House Speaker Paul Ryan have proposed expanding the tax credit for childless workers. Katie Culinary, WHYY News.
News of contaminated water in Flint, Michigan has helped to make lead a four-letter word. Though lead hasn't always been so unpopular. In fact, as Keystone Crossroads' Irina Jorove reports, for decades, it was a desirable plumbing material.
I recently walked down the street from our studio on the south side of Pittsburgh to Vogue True Value Hardware.
You sell plumbing equipment here?
Sure do. What are you looking for?
That's Sean Vogue, the store's owner. I asked him if I could buy some lead piping for my house.
No.
Why not?
It's no longer legal. That's like an old-fashioned thing.
He actually looked slightly horrified that I'd requested lead.
The EPA, you know, monitors the city, and they actually did a run-through here probably within the past year, checking all the hardware stores to make sure that there isn't, you know, anything on the shelves anywhere. We didn't have any, you know. I think it's pretty common sense that you don't want lead in your drinking water.
That wasn't always so.
From a purely engineering perspective, lead had attractive features. It was durable and it was malleable. My name is Werner Truskin. I'm a professor of economics at the University of Pittsburgh.
Truskin wrote a book called The Great Lead Water Pipe Disaster.
If you go back and you read the engineering journals from, say, 1900, you find lots of quotations from engineers saying, look, lead's going to last a really long time. This is really the Cadillac of pipes. We want to use it.
And it's true. Lead does last a really long time. In many cases, pipes installed 100 years ago are doing just fine. At the same time, the health effects of lead were minimized. In the 1800s and early 1900s, some doctors linked miscarriages and various health issues to lead poisoning from pipes, but their data were kind of bad, and other pollutants were a bigger concern. Cities were dealing with rising death rates caused by bacteria. Lead poisoning, on the other hand, was a slower-moving, more elusive problem.
Compare that to, say, if somebody says cholera is a problem or typhoid is a problem. Cholera can kill you in 48 hours.
In Pennsylvania, at the turn of the 20th century, most cities were installing lead service lines. Those are the pipes that run from a large water main to individual houses or buildings. For the bigger mains in the streets, lead was too expensive and too soft. When officials did start to accept that lead wasn't all good, the industry fought back. Richard Rabin, a public health professional who's written about lead, says the industry prolonged its product's reign by lobbying.
They sent some of their staff around the country.
They met with plumbing associations, plumbing code writers, and local, state, and federal government officials.
To urge them to keep using lead pipes. In some cases where lead pipes were banned, they were able to get those bans overturned.
Philadelphia already required lead lines in the early 1900s. According to the Lead Industries Association's meeting minutes from 1938, they successfully pushed codes requiring lead for plumbing in the rest of Pennsylvania that year. At a training center for plumbers outside Pittsburgh, Tom Bigley walks past a 2x4 skeleton of a house where students practice various plumbing skills. One wall is lined with toilets and see-through pipes.
You can see that's what happens when you flush your toilet. It gives you a very good visual on how a plumbing system works.
At another workstation, he picks up a sawed-off chunk of lead water line. It's got a bulge where it connects to a valve.
This is actually called a lead wipe joint. They don't do that anymore, but that was part of the trade back. That's why a plumber, that's where they got their name from. That's a Latin word for lead, lead wiper.
Bigley started out in 1980, but he never learned how to make those joints. By then, lead was a little passé. Copper became the material of choice. Then, plastic. Plus, officials finally accepted the negative health effects of lead exposure. Local and federal agencies banned lead by 1986. But many lead lines remain, and Bigley's never really thought it was a problem. While Flint's experience is giving him pause, Bigley and a fellow plumber, John Inks, say the call to replace all lead lines is complicated and expensive.
Get going crazy over this lead thing. Where's it going to stop, though? Is it going to stop at the lead service lines? Is it going to go into like, oh, okay, that was leaded copper back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, part of the 80s? Where's it going to stop? I don't know. I mean, that's a lot. You're talking a lot of infrastructure.
Because even the houses that have copper, they use 50-50 solder. So right. Now you have the solder joints have lead in them.
Right.
So where's it going to end is right.
Yeah. I mean, the valves. Right?
They're not against the idea of tackling all that infrastructure. They just seem overwhelmed by the thought of it. And the hardest part? Lead's everywhere, but no one knows where exactly. It's not mapped, not documented. Pittsburgh, for one, is planning to try and identify where the lead lines are. And both the Pittsburgh and Philadelphia utilities and other cities are thinking about what it would take to replace them. Irina Zhorov, Keystone Crossroads.
You can learn more about the legacy of lead in Pennsylvania cities at keystonecrossroads.org/lead. Keystone Crossroads is a statewide public media collaboration focusing on Pennsylvania cities, their problems, and potential solutions. WHYY leads the four-station initiative. Tomorrow, voters in Kansas, Kentucky, Louisiana, and Maine will weigh in on whether last night's raucous Republican debate, preceded hours earlier by Mitt Romney's Anybody But Trump appeal, will offer clarity for the party moving forward. Let's get perspective from Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup poll. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
Frank, first off, in this campaign like no other, I'm wondering the extent to which pollsters put aside the playbook from past elections in trying to predict where this season will lead.
Well, I'm not sure it's all that different in that regard, because when pollsters do ask voters who they would vote for, they're measuring what's happening at that particular point in time. It's the pundit, really, who, for example, discussing Donald Trump early on, said it was unlikely that he could be the nominee and so forth.
Last night, Kasich refused to get in the mud, but certainly Rubio and Cruz joined Romney substantially in saying the sky will fall if Donald Trump is the nominee. And yet, at the end of the debate, when each was asked, they would say that they would support Donald Trump if he were the nominee. Does that strike Americans as more politics as usual?
Well, certainly what Donald Trump has going for him based on our data, and these are new data where we just ask Republicans in particular why they support Donald Trump, is that he's not politics as usual, in answer to your question. Number one reason Republicans told us that they would vote for Donald Trump is he's not a career politician. He's an outsider. He would blow things up in Washington and do things differently, and that's what's driving them. And that's really, I think, where the real interesting connection is going on right now between voters and Trump, because the more outrageous things he says, to some degree, the more a lot of Republican voters at any rate say, aha, that's good, because he's not being politically correct in saying things that a normal politician wouldn't say.
So then lay out the roster of groups who most keenly feel that he's gone beyond the pale.
In a lot of key states, the Hispanic vote may be more important than ever in this coming year. And boy, there's negativity there. Here's what we have in our data. Nationwide, Hispanics, 13% have a favorable opinion of Donald Trump, 77% an unfavorable opinion of Donald Trump. We can compare that to Cruz and Rubio. Cruz's image splits even among Hispanics, 30% favorable, 30% unfavorable. And for Marco Rubio, it's 34% favorable, 21% unfavorable. In other words, Rubio has a net favorable image among Hispanics. So it's not just that Trump is a Republican. Among Hispanics, it looks like to us, the issue is that Trump is Trump, and he has alienated Hispanics across the country.
What's the profile on Cruz, Rubio, and Kasich?
We ask supporters who say they would like to see Rubio be president why, in their own words, and here we find kind of an ill-defined image. Well, I kind of like him. He's better than the other people. Some discussion of the fact that he's honest, and also a few Republicans say they would vote for him because he's more electable. For Ted Cruz, senator from Texas, he has two clear things going for him. He's a true conservative, and also the fact that he is a constitutionalist.
Donald Trump takes credit for energizing Republicans as evidenced by turnout at the polls. By contrast, it seems like voting is down in the Democratic primaries. Can we make a connection between what's happening in this spring season and November?
Well, we certainly can. I think it's a good prediction. Right now, all indicators are positive for Republicans in terms of eventual turnout in November. Republicans in our data are giving more thought to the election than Democrats. In our data, Republicans are more enthusiastic about voting in November than our Democrats. And as you mentioned, the data so far in terms of turnout in primary and caucus states show Republicans are much heavier in terms of turnout. Some of this is due to Trump. Some of this is due to the fact that there have been many more candidates running on the Republican side. Some of this is due to the fact there have been more debates, more excitement, higher rated debates. And some of it, we have to say, is structural. This is a time when Democrats have controlled the White House for 8 years, and the out party typically gets more enthusiastic about being able to take the White House back over than the party that is in control. And, of course, that's Democrats.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight. Turning to this evening's headlines, Pennsylvania's unemployment rate dips 1/10 of a percentage point to 4.6%, and that's the lowest rate since September 2007. The national jobless rate also fell, but at 4.9% remains higher than Pennsylvania's. Officials representing New Jersey Transit and rail worker unions have concluded meetings in Washington to try to avert a system-wide rail strike. The two sides met today in front of the National Mediation Board to try to settle differences. A union official says the sides are scheduled to meet again Monday in New Jersey. A strike deadline has been set for next weekend. Partly cloudy, 36 degrees at 6:20. You're listening to Newsworks Tonight on WHYY. This evening's forecast, partly cloudy skies, low overnight, a frosty 28 degrees. Tomorrow, intervals of sun and clouds, Saturday's high 44. Sunday morning starts with a 30% chance of a rain-snow mix, then turning partly sunny, high 47 degrees, and then a warm-up. Monday, mostly sunny, high 57 degrees. Sunshine Tuesday, high 68. And for Wednesday, a spring-like day, mostly sunny, high 72 degrees. It's 621. You're listening to NewsWorks Tonight on WHYY. Still ahead, we'll take up the trials and triumphs of opening a comedy theater in Philadelphia.
Well, it's everything from realizing that you're the person that cleans up the bathroom if someone throws up to, discovering that you're going to become a human resources professional or discovering that you're going to become a bookkeeper.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY.
Too often, when victims of human trafficking ask for help, the answer is, how?
If a victim of trafficking identifies, hey, I want to get out of this situation, I want to get sober, I want to leave my pimp, what do we have to offer? And the short answer is very, very little.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. We wrap up our series on healthcare and human trafficking next time on Marketplace.
Marketplace follows NewsWorks Tonight at 6:30 this evening on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, the Rutgers Camden Professional MBA program. Designed for working professionals, the Rutgers Camden Professional MBA is a 21-month cohort-based program with classes held on Saturdays in two convenient locations, Camden and Princeton. The next cohort begins this fall. Rutgers PMBA will host an information session on Saturday, March 12th at 10:30 a.m. at the Cherry Hill Library. Details at pmba.rutgers.edu or 856-225-2700.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. After producing hundreds of comedy shows across Philadelphia, the creators of $5 Comedy Week are getting ready to open a theater of their own in Center City. Rob Zavatsky reports on the dawn of the Good Good Comedy Theater.
Kate Banford and Aaron Nevin's Kickstarter campaign raised more than $12,000 in less than 48 hours for their planned Good Good Comedy Theater. Banford and Nevins say they've enjoyed putting on shows at places such as Philomoka, a former mausoleum showroom on 12th Street near Callow Hill, but have concluded lacking a permanent home has kept them from building larger audiences. Nevins says the new place will have the same singular rule as they had during their $5 comedy week.
You could do whatever you want, but the one thing you couldn't do was do a show that was just stand-up or just sketch or just improv.
Banford says by blurring the lines between genres, comedians are forced to try new approaches.
It, like, combines improv, sketch, stand-up, storytelling, or whatever other weird thing you do, or it's something completely its own.
On a recent Wednesday night, people were lined up outside Philomoka hoping to catch one of Good Good Comedy's non-traditional shows. Dungeon Pals is a live game of Dungeons & Dragons played by a panel of comedians and randomly selected audience members.
So what do you guys do? You're surrounded by guys.
We should all get onto the sheet and act like we're one of them.
Wait.
Oh, yeah.
Veteran stand-up comedian Paul F. Tompkins got his start in Philadelphia way back in 1986. He says having a theater like the one Banford & Nevins envisioned would have had a huge impact on his career when he was trying to get a break.
People are always wanting to tell you what the rules are of stand-up, and this is how you succeed in the clubs, and this is what you have, quote-unquote, have to do. Just to know that if I had a crazy idea, I could go to someone, I could pitch them and say, I want to make this into a show, and someone would be able to say, yeah, I think you should develop that, and you should figure out what it's going to be, and then you should do it.
Greg Mann, who started the Philly Improv Theater, is encouraging the project, but warns Nevins and Banford they can't possibly anticipate all the hats they will have to wear running their own theater.
Well, it's everything from realizing that you're the person that cleans up the bathroom if someone throws up to, discovering that you're going to become a human resources professional or discovering that you're going to become a bookkeeper.
Blanca Ziska says the Good Good Project shows how much the Philadelphia theater scene is growing. Ziska knows a thing or two about starting a theater and creating productions that challenge conventions. In 1981, she was the founding artistic director of the Wilma Theater and has been there ever since.
Now we are having this really amazing, fruitful situation when theater and performing arts is happening in a huge way around the city. A lot of small companies are being created, and there is this really great fermentation going on.
Aaron Nevins hopes the Good Good Comedy Theater will help expand Philadelphia's repertoire, proving it is a great comedy city.
Philly has some of the greatest comedians in the world, and they're out doing something right now, and it might even only cost me $5 to go see it.
After raising more than double what they sought in the Kickstarter campaign, Banford and Nevins hope to open their venue this summer. They signed a lease and say it will be in Center City, but they are keeping the address a secret until their request for a zoning variance is granted. For WHYY, I'm Rob Zavatsky.
A new shot is fired in the battle to preserve the Princeton battlefield. 9 national preservation groups have formed a coalition to save the portion of the Revolutionary War battlefield in Princeton that's slated for development by the Institute for Advanced Study. From
The Princeton Coalition includes the National Trust for Historic Preservation, the Civil War Trust, and America's oldest patriotic group, the Society of the Cincinnati. 8 such organizations put their collective support behind a local effort to block the Institute for Advanced Study from building faculty housing on a portion of the Princeton battlefield where General George Washington once led a successful counterattack against British soldiers. The president of the Princeton Battlefield Society, Jerry Hurwitz, has been dug in against the Institute for years.
We need this to show the Institute that we're not alone. We're not a voice in the wilderness. We're backed by some of the most important, you know, preservationist groups in the country, not just historic preservation groups, but also environmental preservation groups and veterans groups.
The Institute for Advanced Study, famously the academic home of Albert Einstein, did not immediately return calls. It owns several hundred acres in and around Battlefield Park, much of it under preservation easement. 45 years ago, it struck a deal with the state of New Jersey to cede dozens of acres to Battlefield Park in exchange for the right to build faculty housing on the portion called Maxwell's Field. 2 years ago, the Institute's plan was approved by the Princeton Planning Board. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov and Kimberly Haas. We had help this week from Brett Rader and our intern, Jared Whalen. Our news director is Eugene Son. At the helm this week, Al Banks, Diana Martinez, and Adam Staniszewski. John Musoni is acting vice president of news and civic dialogue. Listen again to a story or catch up on a missed show via podcast or online at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us and have a great weekend. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.